states to agencies attached to that letter. The letter includes some instructions to agencies, and attached to that letter are guidelines for presentations that we expect agencies to follow during their ways and means presentations. There's also a template there to provide a prioritized list of services that the co-chairs wanted, so you can review that material as you want, and then when you get into subcommittee work, we're expecting agencies to follow that procedure as closely as possible. With that, we wanted to give you a briefing on the 0103 situation, and the next handout you have, which starts out with this slide that you see, and Teresa's going to start explaining these slides.
Good morning. For the record, Teresa McHugh from the Department of Administrative Services Budget and Management Division. The series of slides will kind of start walking through both historical context as well as where we are, where we've been in 0103, and how it starts to lead into 0305. And then, as Ken said, he will follow with some charts and some analyses that LFO has done in terms of looking at the budget for 0305. So the first chart just gives some historical context on the general fund and lottery funds over time. And if you look in the bottom left-hand corner, you see back to 89-91, and a couple of things. One is to just look at the sheer number at $4.8 billion and how that was split. And obviously this is pre-ballot measure 5 and the shift to the state of more responsibility for the state school fund. And you see it sitting at 1.176, which was about, I see the percentages got left off of that one, but that was about a little under 25% of the budget at that period of time. Some other things to note is where higher education stood at about 14% of the budget and at about just under $700 million, human services at 23%, and all others sitting at about 19%. As you look forward, going then to the right, you see 99-01. Still at the peak of those 90s when we're in the growth period, and that 4.8 had grown to 10.6. So again, if you looked at over a 10-year period, we had basically more than doubled the budget. But then you do see state school fund where it has kind of where it kind of stabilized out at 42% of the budget, 4.6 billion. You see the all other category down to 6% of the budget, and in real dollars down from 900 to about 600. Now, not all of that, I have to be real clear, not all of that was program reductions. There were some program reductions in that, but during that 10-year period when there was a shifting to K-12, there was a movement to fees and user fees in a lot of agencies as well. So you have to kind of look at those programs and take a look at whether or not they shifted to other funds or whether they actually had a program go away. But you do see higher education, again, going from, it had been at 700, went to 760, but down from 14% to about the 7% range where it has stayed since that period of time. Then if you go up again to the left-hand corner on the top, you see where we were at the end of session, the last session, when we were still at a growth projection, and we were really sitting right at about $12 billion is what was expected for 0103. And you see the split again, K-12 right at about 41%, remembering that K-12, some of you look at it and say, wait a minute, I thought we had 5-2. You did have 5-2. This is general fund and lottery funds only and doesn't account for some of the other discretionary funds over the years that have been used there, like the Medicare upper payment limit, et cetera. Again, higher education city rights, 7%. The all other growing some to 8%, and human resources, again, staying right in about the 22% range. Post-special session 5 is then what happened during this last interim where we went from what we thought was going to be a $12 billion budget to a $10.3 billion, which was the last legislatively approved level. And you can see state school fund looks like it's down to 41%, looks like it's down to $4.2 billion, but remembering that the vast majority of the K-12 dollars were either replaced during the interim with other funds or were the one payment was shifted into 0305. So there was some reduction. The school improvement fund that was going to be put in there, I think about 108, I believe, 112, was removed. And then if you look at the House Bill 5100 reductions tied to ballot measure 28, that's $95 million. And then what's not reflected in this chart is remembering that we had a December forecast after the fifth special session that put the state again into a deficit situation of about $112 million. We'll talk about that a little later. And Governor Kitzhaber implemented an administrative rule to take those reductions across the board for the executive branch. That's about another, I think, $46 million for K-12 out of that piece as well. The next two pages that you have in here are not on the slideshow, and I'm going to go through them just very quickly because Ken will come back to those when he talks about all of the numbers overall for 0305. But those are the charts out of the governor's balanced budget. The first page is the general fund, lottery fund, resources and expenditures. Again, a couple things to note. We are still looking now as we go forward to about $11.4 billion in resources for 0305 is the current projection. You can look at personal income tax. You might remember it at around 80%, is now sitting at 87% of the general fund and lottery funds, with the vast reduction there coming out of the corporate income tax now down right now to the 3% level. And expenditures, you see right at $11.4 billion. And again, if you look at the outline, you see 44% to state school funds. So it went up a little bit in terms of percentage of the budget. In addition, to the general fund and lottery and the state school fund, the remaining Medicare per payment limit dollars that are available in 0305, about $73 million, I believe is the number, is in there as well, which is what gets you to the $5.05 billion that we've talked about for K-12. State school fund. Again, you can look at the numbers. Other education, higher education, community colleges maintaining about their same percentage as they've had in the past. All other, again, down a little to about 6% again. Human resources at 20%, so you can kind of get a sense of where those were taken. In terms of the total funds, resources at $83.4 billion and expenditures at $36.3. The difference there, why we don't expend all those dollars, is those are the major trust funds, the PERS trust fund, the highway trust fund. Those are the constitutionally and statutorily dedicated funds that cannot be just used for expenditure purposes, are included in that total resource number for the purposes of when we report budget for the state under GAAP and accounting principles. But looking at expenditures, we've been sitting, the $36.3 billion is pretty equivalent to where we've been during the current biennium in terms of total funds. Okay. Now, we're getting back onto the chart. The other way to look at the budget, and again, I think Ken's going to give you a little more of this later, is not by just program area, but when you're looking at the state dollars, how do they flow out of the state? And it is important, especially as you think about K-12. The vast majority of the state general fund and lottery fund go out in the form of a special payment. Meaning we write a check, but those people ultimately who get those dollars are not state employees. We don't run that operation. The vast majority of that special payment is to K-12, and the 198 local school districts then make the decisions about employees, compensation, et cetera. Personal services accounts for about 20.6% of the 0305 balance budget at about $2.35 billion. And those are the state employees and all of the associated costs paid for with general fund and lottery funds for state employees. Services and supplies at about 8%, a little under $1 billion, and then capital outlay at 0.4%. So that just gives you another way to look at how the dollars flow. And remembering that when you talk, for example, about personal services, K-12, when they will talk to you about it, is 85% roughly driven by personal services and their expenditures. The state is an indirect player. So even when you're looking at issues such as how many positions are impacted by certain reductions, you may not see a lot of positions, for example, in human services because those dollars flow out to another provider or a contractor, whereas in public safety, we actually have the staff, and you'll see much more personal services driven there. And so we do need to talk to our other folks that we work with about what the impact is to the economy when we cut those payments and how many positions are impacted. One of the issues, what's kind of caused this growth since 1989? Obviously, we've just talked about a lot more dollars flowed into the state during that 10-year period. So what's caused the growth in terms of expenditure around the general fund? The primary pieces are really population initiatives and policy decisions, but we also, as you know, have been impacted by inflation and lawsuits, and you have all seen those in individual areas. And again, given that over 90% of the budget is spent, of the general fund lottery budget, is spent in human services, public safety, and education, we're going to focus a little bit on those three big areas and what the major drivers have been. But you can see on page 6 that population has continued to grow. Now, you're going to see it's flattening out a little bit, and Paul Warren and Tom Petowski may be talking a little more about this. But you can certainly see very, very steady growth during the 1990s. So as we talk about our populations around K-12, et cetera, university system, they'll want to be having a discussion with you not only about where they're spending their money, but about the impact of population, just sheer population growth on their service level. Page 7 gives you a picture, again, back to 89-91, and then showing where we were at close of session for 01-03, and the lightest colored bar there is the governor's balanced budget of how the general fund is spent by program area. And again, with the kind of picture, often when I go out to folks outside of Salem, they'll say, well, what we'd like you to do is not take anything from education, human services, or public safety, and go to everything else. And this one really does give a nice visual of, well, that would be really wonderful if there was any dollars in anything else, but really, that's where the vast majority of the funds are spent. If you look at education, and that picture right there, why there's been such huge growth, again, most of that related to the state picking up ballot measure 5 and picking up what was no longer being paid for by property tax. Human resources, probably the vast majority of that growth was seen in the Oregon Health Plan around increasing caseloads, as well as just the inflationary costs around the health care system. And public safety has a lot to do with ballot measure 11 and the sentencing guidelines that went along with that in terms of building prison beds. When we talk about public safety, when you look at that budget, those of you who are on that committee, you will see that there's somewhere between $100 and $120 million general fund right off the top for debt service for the building of the prisons that has already occurred. So, again, that's a lot of that is around both the housing, but right now also just the building of the prisons to house the inmate population. Page 8 goes right into looking at K-12 and gives you a picture over time of also the local resources, because we in the state don't budget the local resources, and sometimes that piece gets missed as we talk about the K-12. But if you look in 91-93, you see that the state, obviously an important player to K-12 funding, but the minority player, with the majority of the funds coming from local property tax. You then see where that's gone over time, with the state picking up obviously a majority player in that. I don't have it here, but I believe by the time you have staff coming into your committees, they'll be able to also talk to you about if you adjust just for a population and just basic inflation over time, how does that number look? And it doesn't look like K-12 has gotten a lot more resources overall when adjusted for those things over time. The far right-hand column just says if we were still under the old proportions and taxpayers had said we're willing to let the property tax continue to grow at 6%, where would it be in terms of just that same percentage if we went back to the 91-93 percentage? How much would the state be investing in K-12? And it would be that smaller bar on the top. One of the things that's been looked at, and I think they'll also be able to talk to you about, is how this also compares to the quality ed model and what those numbers look like. But that gives you just a picture of both the local and state. The next two pages do give you a little bit of numbers into how the governor's balanced budget impact where we are today and how those dollars for K-12 got spread in the current biennium from where we were at close of session to where we are now. And we looked at it by year because we tend to always look at everything in a biennial sense, and yet schools budget on an annual basis. So if you look back 01-02 and 02-03, and you have both for those districts, because there are some that said they're not going to do accrual, if you did no accrual, which is the shift, and if you incorporate the shift. But you can see that basically schools did not take the reduction in the first year. All the reduction is in the second year. And so you see that the school funding a little bit higher, obviously, in 01-02, and then takes the drop in 02-03. If you look at 03-04 and 04-05, this then gives you the comparison off of where schools should be from the year they are in to the year we're going to. So again, obviously the governor's budget proposes that schools spend those dollars that are above the 2002-03 year for classroom and for trying to keep school days whole and class sizes down, and not for compensation. But that gives you a picture of how of what that looks like. And you see a little disparity between the 2 years because of factors like teacher turnover, what the expectations are about teacher turnover, as well as local property tax. But again, when you get into the committee, you'll be able to have a lot more discussion. There's a lot more work being done to try and separate the years and be able to really talk about what happens from year to year. The next page does the same thing, but shows it by per ADMW and looks at where we are. So you see 0102 right under the 5100 level, $5,100 per student ADMW. 0203, we're right under 5,000 and restoring over to over 5,200 in 0304 from the state state funding. If you look at page 11, again, this is just another graphic of what the state contribution has been to K-12, and again, the line up and then that we've really stabilized out since 97-99 in terms of the state contribution to K-12. The next page, and part of the purpose for the next page is to look at the next, which gives you the rest of the education environment, what's happened to them over time. And community colleges and student assistance staying about even, going down a little. Higher education, again, taking a significant drop from the what had been their norm in the 85, 87, 89, 91 level down to a low of 6.4% in 95, 97. So, again, and in OUS, when you get into those budgets, you want to talk about how much of that has been replaced by tuition. You know, what are the things that have been done there? So not all of that necessarily means all of their funding level went down to that level. But, again, some went to tuition, but they'll also want to have a discussion about enrollment, which are really the next two charts around the post-secondary. Page 13 gives you a picture of community colleges support fund, and it's the dollars per full-time equivalent student. Again, community colleges, much like the state school fund, we make a special payment. The community college districts and boards decide how those funds are going to be spent. But again, we were at a high, and I think you remember you made an investment last session in community colleges, which through the fifth special session, basically most of it had to come back out. But we were at a high of 2413 per FTE, accommodating some of the enrollment growth, down to 1951 in the governor's budget. So even though they stay at about the same percentage of the general fund lottery fund budget, because of the enrollment growth and the population increases they're seeing in number of kids wanting access to community college, their per FTE student amount has dropped. They look at it a little different, but the university system will talk to you about head count and what they expect to see. Again, same kind of thing, just from a different perspective on students. And you see the actuals in terms of the growth they've experienced as well as what they project. But we are still having four more kids and adults wanting to enter our post-secondary institutions. And so, again, we're keeping resources about the same percentage, but in terms of how they spread and what they do there has been an issue. And they will be talking to you about that in terms of how that plays out for both access as well as quality when they come to the table. The next page, page 15, moves into human services, and again, the health plan being such a big driver there, we wanted to give kind of a picture of the health plan over time. And I would encourage you, after the other charts, the scale doesn't look like huge growth, but please look at the scale of dollars on the left in terms of the growth that really is there, and it really is a scale issue. But there's two pieces. One is you can see the growth there from basically a $200 million budget in 89-91 to $1.2 billion in 0103 when we left session, and again this includes, in this case we've included tobacco tax and the tobacco settlement dollars that were there. One of the things to always keep in mind in human services and with the health plan, for example, though, is look at the dotted line. That's the total funds. And remembering that for every dollar we spend there, the state funds in there, we are matching two federal dollars. And so as you look at those budgets, taking into account the federal dollars that are flowing in the economy in the state of Oregon and in the healthcare system, and as we look at the health plan, will be reduced commensurate to that. So we always want to make sure people have an understanding of the federal fund impact as well. The next two pages talk a little bit, again, of putting in context how the governor's budget got to a starting place around the health plan and CHIP, which is the children's the specific children's program and population there. And you can see that on caseload projections, the caseloads have been built in. So as you look at human services, the mandatory caseloads in those programs have been built in. And the basic OHP2 waiver framework is still in place. So the governor's budget has not said we've thrown out the health plan. It's left it there as a starting place for discussions. If you look at the next page, however, you see where the dollars came from, and it's the monthly cost per eligible. Eligibles are included, but the monthly cost per eligible has been reduced from the 0103 even November rebalance level. Clearly, in human services, there's going to be has to be a discussion about access. At this level, providers may say, you know, geez, I don't think I want to serve your clients. So you have them on a caseload, but you would have an access issue. Probably more than any other part of the budget, this really is a place of saying we really have this as a starting point. The issue isn't as much we didn't want to throw the framework out, for example. The governor was clear he didn't want to say, I've already thrown the framework out, but to say providers and stakeholders and the legislature need to come together, and we need to have a discussion of how you look at the resource level and talk about how we can sustain whatever growth we have in this over the next decade. We've been growing at 20% to 30% per biennium. And clearly the revenue picture isn't going to allow us to do that. If it does, it's going to eat the dollars from the rest of that pot, which is, again, public safety and education. So it's really saying that we have to bring our total dollars into play and sit down with everyone and talk about what the right balance is for services, for eligibles, for provider rates, et cetera, to have a system that's sustainable over time. But I think that as much as any part of the budget, this one really goes into a starting place for discussion about how you move forward on the health plan. Moving into public safety, and again, with the vast majority there being in DOC, took a little bit of a picture at the historical and the forecast prison population and kind of looking at time of when certain things came in. Growth from 85 to 90, and you see in 89, 90 is when sentencing guidelines came in and then tapered that growth off. Measure 11 came in. The Senate Bill 1145 took a little dip, but then you see the growth chart, both actuals and then the forecast out, with it really starting to kind of level off a little bit, but still growth. The next page gives you just the impact of the additional inmates and what it would have looked like pre-Measure 11 and post-Measure 11. So this just gives you a sense of the growth in the prison population, both in terms of ongoing costs of maintenance as well as what the cost was in terms of context of building the capacity to house inmates. And then when you get into those budgets, you'll also hear about things that were some of the other pieces that maybe weren't as thought about at the time. For example, health care costs in the prison system, which have escalated as we're keeping people longer into their adult lives. And so there will be lots of discussions, I think not only around construction and what you need to house the population, but then maintenance over time. In the governor's budget, you're not going to see new construction in 0305 being proposed. There is a delay in the construction schedule. So it continues the debt service for construction today, and you'll see them moving to, at least for the next biennium, more rental beds and temporary beds, and I'm sure there'll be lots of policy discussions around that. Now, looking into kind of, again, context of what happened and where are we going, and kind of leading you in, and we'll go a little bit more back to budget before you get there, but leading you into the discussion you'll be having at 10 forward on the revenue picture, kind of take a look at what happened to us over the last decade and over the last couple of years. And you can see very, very steady and healthy growth in the general fund. This is general fund only, from 94 to 2001. And so what the legislature was experiencing every session was that whatever ending balance they left grew by a substantial amount when you came back in the next 2 years. And you can see in 01, just a very dramatic and steady drop there over the interim. And again, most of that coming, we actually did have our first forecast. I think actually the last forecast for 0305 at the close of session said we expect growth to taper off. September was actually down, the September forecast, before September 11th. But then after September 11th, a very significant drop from that level. That was kind of when it really dove down. Just as important, and you'll again get those folks here to talk about, but just as important is to look at what's projected out as we think about 0305. And again, as we talk about $11.4 billion, and in the context of the growth and where we thought budgets would be for where we are, it's a low number. If you think about it, that we are sitting right now at a projection of 10.2 for the current biennium, it's actually showing significant growth to think about in the next 2 years, we'll go from a $10.2 billion generation to an 11.4. So again, saying that basically it won't go back up to that top bar, but it will now have a steady growth, and that we are coming out of the recession, not expecting a double dip and going back into a growth pattern. And the next page just again visually shows this as well, that says collections overall will improve by 18% in the next 2 years, and once you adjust those for the kickers and the and pension adjusted collections, at 13.6. So again, I emphasize as we go into the next 2 years, I think the governor as well wants to sit down and have a discussion about what our strategy is of whether or not that's a growth projection that we think is sustainable. And again, we'll have a couple more forecasts, but that would be the kind of the key here, is to understand this shows a pretty healthy recovery. Page 22 talks a little bit about lottery resources.
If you were in an airplane and you made a turn like this, you'd be blacked out.
Well, Air Force analogy, not. Okay,
well, and I haven't used that one yet.
Oh, Dad.
I'm sure the revenue forecasters would be explaining that story.
And what the assumptions are and how that's built.
Yeah.
Page 22, again, we've been it's been very interesting. Lottery collections and resources do not seem to have been dampened by the recession, neither in Oregon or in other states, so which is kind of an interesting piece. But it is important to kind of know what's happened to our lottery resources over time. 95-97 was the peak year for the legislature to have significant lottery resources for discretionary purposes. Then over time, certain things have locked up the lottery where less and less of it has become available for discretionary purposes. And certainly this chart gives you a picture that you actually have less as you look at 03-05 than you had in 01-03 for discretionary purposes based on the latest lottery forecast. Again, the Parks and Natural Resource Funding, the ballot measure 66 dedication. We have the Education Endowment, now the Rainy Day Fund piece. And then debt service being a significant portion as well from the issuance of lottery bonds. Those lottery bonds have been used for a number of different things, from economic and community development, but this is also still in, I believe it was 97-99 and 99-01, we issued lottery bonds for education. We still have to, we have those to be paid back as well, and that's built in, as you can see. Then we just go to our favorite, our reminders. And some of these are things we've already kind of touched on, but we are out. The December forecast did leave us out of balance by $111.8 million. The governor, former governor, Governor Kitzhaber, issued an administrative rule that took those reductions across the executive branch agencies and in an across-the-board fashion by appropriation line, which means at the moment we are balanced to zero. Governor didn't have the discretion to leave an ending balance there. So we are balanced to zero. There are two more forecasts for the current biennium as well as then the actual collections to make sure we do end the biennium in a balanced position. And then, of course, even if ballot measure 28 passes, which would restore the reductions that are in House Bill 5100, we would still be making the reductions that are in the 111.8 at this point to be in a balanced situation. For 0305, when you left session, you thought you'd be sitting at about $13 billion coming into this session. And obviously that's dropped to $11.4 billion. And again, as we talked about, $11.4 billion is actually based on a pretty healthy recovery scenario. Worst case scenario, and again, this worst case scenario is based on taking the current factors and saying if they all go the wrong way, if it's the lowest projection on those collections under the current economic situation, could be as much as $700 million lower than that $11.4. The next page again just gives some pictures because there's been lots of numbers out there. Again, at close of session, we also produced a tentative budget for you and said that we expected to be right at about $13.3 billion based on legislative action. So basically in not a completely balanced, but based on prior sessions and what you could have expected in growth, in a pretty healthy situation. Currently, without, if the 5100 cuts did not occur and you said you wanted to continue all of those programs, it cost you about $13.7 billion. some of the additional cost there with that 13.3 is property tax values came in at a significantly lower number than had been anticipated. So some of that's around K-12, for example. Caseloads that are mandatory are built in there. So we are constantly kind of updating that number. But basically, I think Ken can, we'll talk about it more, but most of the news that has come in this biennium on either the expenditure side or the resource side has been in the wrong direction. If you carry the 5,100 cuts forward, then those...
Excuse me, question?
I just wondered how you got to your 18%. What's the basis by the governor forecasting the budget on an 18% recovery rate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, you'll have the forecasters here. That's the official forecast from the Office of Economic Analysis that's done in connection with the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors. And they're going to be here and talk about both their process and what the assumptions are that are built into that.
So they're going to come in and tell us the reasonable assumptions are 18%.
They're going to be able to talk about how they got there. By law right now, the governor must use those forecasts as well as the legislature to balance. And so they do give you, they do a range of forecasts and actually put out a large document with all the assumptions, but that is the current projection they have. So, again, I think that's a question that when they come is probably better suited to them.
Yes, but he can't agree to spend less. Is that, I mean, just
correct.
He can balance the budget but leave a portion
yes,
at the end.
Yes.
But he chose not to do that.
I think, Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, when you look at it, I think it really came down to a point of saying, first of all, we want to come in here as a starting place, and I think he actually would like to talk about additional reserves. I think it was a discussion of at the program levels that were in there, he felt it was inappropriate to reduce the program levels any further at this point, but rather to enter into that discussion and talk about how do we have appropriate reserves while still maintaining a minimum level of services. But, yes, I think he also would like to have a healthier reserve. The House Bill 5100 cuts carried forward actually equate that $310 million in the current biennium equates to about $1.1 billion if you carry all of those program reductions forward for the next 2 years. So, again, if you carry those forward, you're at 12.6, again, still out of line with an $11.4 billion forecast. What are some of those things? Why have those costs gone up? Again, we have reduced programs, which have reduced the cost. PERS employer rate increases have been, again, another major piece as we look forward to the next biennium in terms of cost, reduced property tax value, medical inflation has certainly been an issue, and then we have the 5,100 cuts. In general, we always kind of do the, what are the other things out there we'd like you to be thinking about? The general risk in this budget. Again, you'll see every program area will have its challenge, but there is a general risk as we go forward because the budgets are very tight around everything from lawsuits of folks coming back and saying if you're going to provide this service, there's a minimal level of service that should be there, to forest fires, to, again, keeping a very low reserve puts us in a general risk situation. Cash flow could be an issue for us if we don't go into this recovery mode. Again, from the standpoint of this all reflects, when we talk about the forecast, is projecting how much cash is going to come into the state over the next 2 years. In the first year of this biennium, we were $1 billion lower than what we anticipated having in cash, reflected about $10 billion in the economy. I mean, that's the other thing we always have to keep in mind is our play in that we're one player, but there was actually about $10 billion, I believe, less in the economy.
Excuse me, Teresa. Question, Senator Winter?
Thank you. Just a question, because you talked about some of the general risk, and you didn't mention our bond rating.
Right now, we are, Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, we are on a negative outlook. We actually don't get another rating until we go out and try and sell something, which is always then a little bit of the risk. Right now, the bond rating companies are watching all states very closely, and they are giving more signals than they sometimes do. For example, they've given signals about how much they like to see states using tobacco securitization. Illinois was going to go out and increase using more of their tobacco securitization for operating costs, and they sent out a message saying they weren't sure they liked that. So they don't come right out and tell you if you do this, your rating is going to drop, but they have sent out some general messages. I think in general they're watching Oregon closely. They're asking a lot of questions about the balance. They, again, I think, are pleased to see that the legislature did act and keep the state in balance, are pleased to see a budget in balance. They are concerned in general, I think, about one-time use of one-time funds in states and what the long-term kind of balance is going to be. But that may be something where you might want to think about having the treasurer come in and talk about his feedback on what kind of balance do you need to have here. Cash flow, again, feeds into that, actually, in terms of the risk there, with the biggest one being that as we've shifted payments into July, making sure our cash situation, if this recovery doesn't occur quite at this level, is there to be able to make those payments in July 03 to schools. So we are working on cash flow projections right now to make sure that we either have the cash available or that the treasurer is comfortable borrowing internally to make those payments. If we go into a situation of looking at having to issue tax anticipation notes, always keep in mind those have to be issued against a balanced budget. So they couldn't be issued for that payment unless we have a balanced budget for 03-05. So we're working with the treasurer on those issues, and again, I think that is going to be an important thing to have him come in here and talk at some point. But we are working with them right now on a cash flow projection.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Butler.
Along that line, Teresa, one question relative to the balanced budget. Right now we've got 4 months to finish out the balance of this current fiscal biennium, and then we've got 24 months. And one thing that we could do is that we could, by legislative action, actually borrow from within the existing funds that are within the state, and in effect balance the 4 months and then ration all of the resources we've got over 28 months. Couldn't we do that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I think there's probably something there for us to look at. It's one of those that I would encourage, as we do it, we keep your counsel and the Attorney General involved to make sure that we are doing it in a way that doesn't cause us greater risk down the line. But certainly there's a way for us to take a look at some of those things. I would assume that's going to be on the list of looking at our other fund resources and see what's appropriate that we can actually do.
Mr. Chair, I just, in that regard, I think it's important to note that we could be in a balanced budget situation, and the tax anticipation notes could be, in effect, borrowed and paid back against a balanced budget from monies which we already have on hand that the state has control over some of those funds. We could, as a legislature, as a sitting legislature, we can balance the 01-03 biennium budget by borrowing from within and then make certain that we have the resources to pay those back within the 03-05 and obligate ourselves to pay those back. And I think that that's important, that we could, in effect, ration the services which we are presently providing that are, in other words, what we've got is we've got a shutdown for 4 months projected in some of the programs and then a jump start to start it back up so that you're actually turning off the power for 4 full months and then anticipating that on July 1st everything starts back up at a reasonable pace again. Whereas I'm saying that I think that we have fiscal authority to do so, to ration within those 28 months and have a balanced budget and have tax anticipation notes, which could be on a balanced budget for the current biennium and still pay back over the 28 months all of the services and provide it wouldn't be a Cadillac, but it wouldn't be a jump start on a program that had been dead stopped either.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I think lots of issues there, and obviously the treasurers are expert on tax anticipation notes and would want to talk to you about that. I know it has to be within fiscal periods mm-hmm. that it's actually repaid, but I think the issue of having us working with your staff on how do you make sure wherever you want to be in 03-05 that there's a smooth line, mm-hmm. the degree you can have between 01-03 and 03-05, that's certainly something that we as staff have already talked about. How do we help look at ways for that to happen? So, again, I think that's one of the ways to talk about doing that. And, again, at some point we'll have the cash flows and be in a situation where I think the treasurer can actually help you look at some of those things.
Just a comment, if I may, on be interested, because the implication, I think, from Representative Butler's comments are that we, rather than stop certain programs, then restart them, you know, 4 months later, we go through some mechanism to keep them going. It's my understanding from this budget that these programs don't restart, that the governor continues those reductions into his 03-05 projection. So there's no real point. I'm wondering what the strategy is, why we would do the strategy you're pointing out at this point in time. If the programs aren't anticipated to be started up again, there's really no point in keeping them alive at this stage of the game.
Mr. Chair, and that smooth transition anticipates that those programs which are being targeted for complete shutdown right now have no efficacy, and I think that there's some concern within the building that is really the correct conclusion to draw from the actual shutdown of those programs. So I guess what I'm saying is that perhaps there are other administrative savings within some of those very departments, and Senator Winters will be working on some of those. There are anticipated savings that could basically deliver those local service programs that are being cut out, and we're saying they're of no further value. And unfortunately, the decision to cut some of those programs out is merely a shift, and I don't think the shift has been actually taken into consideration. When we shift from the human services side and say these are services which we will no longer provide, they're gone, and then we say, but that will have absolutely no impact on the public safety side. In many cases, that's a fallacy in thinking, because what you're going to do is you're going to shift out of a methadone program folks that are going to be on the streets that presently may cost us $200 a month as a state to maintain them, and move them into a prison program, it's going to cost us $5,000 a month. And we have every bit the obligation to take care of the folks and maintain the public safety on the other end. So I guess what I'm looking at is that smooth transition that Ms. McHugh has referenced here, that really there wouldn't be a smooth transition, that we need to make certain that whatever the services that are logically maintained need to be so maintained in such a fashion that there would be a smooth transition and not a overloading of the system under the public safety from human services.
Continue.
PERS and labor costs, this budget does include a 25% in employment rates for state employees for schools, so that is built into the budget, is that 25% increase. But you may recall that in December the board indicated that based on the actuarial information that the increase could be substantially more than that. There's nothing built in addition to that, with the governor being very clear that he wants to take steps to ensure that rate increase does not occur. So not asking agencies or K-12 to absorb that additional increase, but saying we're going to take steps to control those costs so that rate increase doesn't occur above 25%. He's also been clear that he would like to get that below that 25% rate increase, and then that would actually free up dollars in this budget.
Teresa, if the December increase in liability is added in, what would the effective rate increase be?
I think the effective rate increase, do you recall, Ken, it goes up to about 40%? 35 to 40%, I think.
I think employer rates would go up from about 20.28% of salary up to about 24%.
Something like that. So it'd be almost another, I guess, 20% increase over the 25% increase. In terms of dollars for the general fund and lottery in here, it's about $182 million in increased cost for that 25%. So, again, you'd be looking at probably another $100 to $125 million if we couldn't achieve those additional increases. But, again, with the governor being very upfront that we need to take the steps to make sure that occurs. Kicker. I know right now it doesn't seem likely, but one of those things to keep in mind, especially as you start your legislative agenda around economic recovery, is that if you have an agenda around economic recovery, and if it occurs, and it's not built into the May 15th end of session forecast, even if you're successful, it will go out in the form of the kicker, because that May 15th forecast is the baseline that's used for the calculation of the kicker. So, given if we end the biennium at a low note and then have a huge recovery, you just need to keep that in mind that's there. And additional lawsuits. Again, this is part of that general risk, but just being aware that there are folks out there who have talked to us about the fact that if we reduce services, that we have a risk around them approaching the state through the lawsuit mechanism. So I think you want to just be aware that that's out there. And I think that finishes this set, and Ken will go on to give a little more context around the budget itself that has been presented by the governor.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair, if you could refer back to slide 17 briefly. the cost per eligible projections for the OHP and the CHIP. Do you have an estimate of just a typical family of four? What would be the cost for that family of four?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, I don't have that off the top of my head. In terms of right now, I think we go up to, Senator Winters is going to help me here. I think we go up to about 185 of the federal poverty, percent of the federal poverty level in terms of their care. In terms of dollars per family, in terms of what the health care cost is, I don't have that right off the top, but I'd be happy to get somebody to give me kind of a set of, are you thinking about, like, do they get $600 a month or?
Well, I guess very simply my question is, are these added? If we're looking roughly at something in excess of $250 per eligible participant, you have then two adults. That's $250 times
great.
Two. Is that the way you're projecting that? Or would that be inaccurate?
When we get into the human services overview, you will get all that information and more.
This is actually a composite, so you're correct. I believe there is some difference there based on that. But again, we're happy to have somebody sit down and kind of go through all of this detail because it can actually kill you in detail. But I'd be happy to get you kind of a little more on the.
Well, if we're going to be covering it in our subcommittee, then I appreciate that.
Oh, no problem.
Thank you.
Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, Carissa, back on page 5, you had initiative costs, of course, Measure 11. What were the other major ones, and do you have them broke out as to how they drove the budget?
I think if you look at education, ballot Measure 5, certainly, and if you probably the best chart there is looking at that, the chart, mm-hmm. ballot Measure 5 is really looking at the chart on page 8 mm-hmm. that would give you a sense of where the proportion would have been. It's really that, it's that gap between what we're spending and that black, and what is there is really driven by ballot Measure 5. Ballot Measure 11, certainly in the public safety area. And then in terms of your lottery discretionary resources, ballot Measure 66 has been a factor. But those are really the largest ones. There have been others, but in terms of really large impact, those would be the major ones.
Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Co-Chair Schrader. I just want to be clear before we move on. Using an 18% assumption, what's the impact on this institution if that number comes in significantly less, and yet we build our budget on an 18% assumption?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I think the one of the issues is how much time do you want to spend here in an interim? That's really the key. Is as a body under the Constitution, we're required to have a balanced budget. So the less ending balance resources you have, if it's not clear we're going to come out of that, then in effect we would be coming back into special sessions as collections come in lower than that if they weren't achieved.
Just one last follow-up.
Which is then program reductions or other resources.
And just like, again, just so I'm clear, so based upon the 18% projection, if this body chose to accept that number and move forward on it and the number came in at 13%, we would find ourselves again in a special session.
That is correct.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much for that comprehensive overview.
Mr. Chair, next we have a series of just a few slides that will show you an overview of the governor's budget. Some of these you've already gotten details from Teresa on, but we're going to go through these relatively quickly because we anticipate Mr. Warner and Mr. Pitowski being here at 10 to talk about the revenue situation, which seems to have caught your interest this morning. The first slide just shows the total budget by fund type, and you can see I need to point out the percentage numbers under lottery and the other funds are wrong. We'll get you an updated slide. But you combine the general fund, $10.9 billion, and the lottery funds of $0.5 billion, and that's the $11.4 billion that Teresa has been talking about. You can see that there's a large portion of other funds in the state budget. If you combine the other funds and the non-limited other funds, you get roughly about 50% of the budget. Another way of looking at the total budget is by category of expenditure. Teresa showed you a slide earlier that showed on the general fund side what portion of the budget is spent in special payments. The total budget, again, has about 65% of the total budget is in special payments, which are payments to providers, to the state school fund, and entities like that outside of what you typically would think of as state government in terms of staff and employees. And I think it's also worth noting the amount of debt service that the state is currently paying. About 5% of the budget is in debt service. Personal services makes up about 16% of the 16 to 17% of the total, and this is all funds budget. If you look at the major program areas in the general fund and general and lottery fund, this is the total of $11.4 billion. Again, as Teresa showed you, the one bar chart that shows that there's not much money in the non-education, human services, and public safety arenas, basically you can see about 6% of the budget is not in those particular areas of the general fund and lottery fund budget. Other funds by major program area, administration makes up about 26%. That includes the PERS system, and that is the primary reason for the size of that particular piece of this pie chart. The next slide shows you, again, just a different view of that $17 billion in other funds. Roughly 25% of the total is from PERS, $4.3 billion, and then higher education is next. So you can see it's over half of the budget is other funds budget is made up by four agencies of the state. The next slide shows the federal funds by major program area. And as you're well aware, because of the matching dollars that we get from the federal government in the human services area, this makes up by far the largest piece of the federal funds budget of the state, which totals about $7.2 billion. Statewide, by program area, this is all funds. It just gives you another graphic to show you the relative size of these major program areas of the state. Again, education with over $10 billion. Is the largest single section. And this is all funds, and that's the reason administration and economic development show higher. The next slide shows just general fund and lottery. So you can see, again, the big users of our general fund to get our education, human services, public safety, and judicial. And I think in most of the presentations you're going to see the rest of this week, we are combining public safety and judicial branch together. Because of the interconnected nature of those two program areas of the state system.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Butler.
Just one point of clarification on page 3, the education $3.4 billion of other funds, that doesn't include tuition, does it?
Yes, it would.
It does include tuitions. All right, thank you.
The next slide just shows the change over time in the general fund and lottery from the 9901 actuals to what was legislatively adopted at the close of session. Legislatively approved after the fifth special session, and this is including the assumes the House Bill 5100 Section 2 cuts, which are tied up with the ballot measure 28. This assumes they are in place. And then the governor's budget. And you can see an 11% growth in the governor's budget between that close of session estimate and the 0305 balanced budget. However, the reason I think you can see in the next slide is because of discretionary spending, the growth is really only about 4% growth because as you know, in special session, a lot of the reductions in general fund were made up with one-time resources, including tobacco settlement dollars, the education stability fund resources, and then the bonds from the tobacco settlement money. And with those changes in place, the governor has tried to back out some of those one-time sources and have to restore them with additional general funds.
And the 4% growth is from the House Bill 5100 reduced level.
Correct. Yes.
All the slides.
Ken, does that include the December forecast?
We probably wouldn't have that in there, so.
That would not be in that estimate. Because that was not current law at the time.
Any other questions, Mr. Rockwell? We're just sponges here today. Not a problem. I believe.
Mr. Chair, Paul Warner was at the House Revenue Committee this morning, so he was going to try to be here as close to 10 as he could. So until he gets here, we...
Mr. Murkowski's here if we wanted to
Move
ahead.
Okay.
Yes. Just, go, Chair. Mr. Rocco, on the first little pie chart you gave us, on page one of our handout, the lottery funds amounting to $500 million are said to constitute 17.6%.
Mr. Chair, I mentioned that there are some percentage mistakes on that chart, and that should be about 1.4%.
Thank you.
And the other funds below that, it says 30.1. That should be closer to 18%. But I will revise this chart and get you a good copy.
Co-chairs don't sleep up here. We're just checking that math. Little pocket calculator next to.
This is not a pocket calculator.
Any other questions of Mr. Rocco? Well, why don't we have Mr. Potowski come on up? I think we can move ahead. Okay, but
yeah, you bet.
That's Butler's fault.
Yeah, right.
You see the one he has at his office.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Tom Potowski, State Economist, Office of Economic Analysis. Also with me today is Michael Kennedy, also with the Office of Economic Analysis.
Welcome.
And just shortly we'll have our presentation up here. And there should be handouts going around to each of the members.
Kidding.
Okay. Yes. Okay. All right. Today, wanted to give you a bit of a review. We're not going to concentrate really on our economic forecast per se, but we really want to give you some more insight into our methodology and in the process of how we come up with the revenue forecast, and then also to answer some of the questions we've heard today that you had of the presenters before us. So I'm going to keep my comments rather short and let Michael lead into the main discussion so that we have a lot of information so we have time to do it. So next one. The objectives for the office really is to produce unbiased forecasts of general fund revenues. What we mean by that, by the word unbiased, is that we'd like to have over time equal likelihoods of being under or over the actual revenues. In the sense that, you know, we are trying to find what we think is the best baseline forecast of what's out there. And because of uncertainties over a two-year period of time, both in terms of economic changes, there can be legislative changes, there can be the lawsuits that we've seen in the past times, it can fluctuate around what this forecast is. But what we'd like to do is narrow those fluctuations as much as possible. But by being unbiased, there should be a likelihood of just being as many times underneath the forecast as there is above the forecast. So over time, we hope these average errors should approach zero. And we'll have other graphs associated with that later. So let's go in.
Just as yes. word, I'm going to I'd like to welcome Senator Crow to our discussions. I'd like to hold questions till the end. There's quite a bit of material here, but please note down your questions as they go through this, and then when they get through it in its entirety, we'll ask our questions. If that's all right.
Okay, for general fund forecast components, really the big gorilla here is the personal income tax, making well over 85% of the general fund revenues that come in. We also have the corporate income tax collections that we project, and these are all net of projected refunds. OEA also forecasts cigarette and tobacco, gift and inheritance, and other taxes, as well as interest earnings, and various other small general fund revenue sources. And these all together constitute about 96% of the general fund revenues. Also, other agencies provide us directly with their own forecasts for various areas, and we take those and fold those into the forecast. Very brief, and this is sort of the overall view of the methodology that we use on the forecast. We start off with a meeting with the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors. In fact, Friday, the 17th, we met in Portland with the Council to kick off our forecasting process for the March 1 forecast that's coming up. In that forecast, in that process, we collect U.S. economic history and the forecast for the future for the U.S. economy. These are some major drivers in the Oregon economic model. We use a firm called Global Insight, which is a national forecasting firm, to provide us with some of that information. At this meeting, we then get information from our governor's council, what they believe the U.S. economy is likely to do, how they feel about the National Forecasting Service, their views on it, and we also get we look at the most recent information on the Oregon economy. We use then a history of what's happened in the Oregon economy. We have a preliminary economic forecast that we put together, and then we have another meeting where we meet with two groups. We meet with the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors again, and then also the DAS Advisory Committee, which is made up of various agencies that use our information and also have pulses on what the economy is doing. People from employment, from agriculture, forestry, and so forth. After that meeting, we then finalize our economic forecast, and then that becomes the driver then for both our personal income tax models and our corporate income tax models. We work those models out. We also then incorporate any legislative and policy changes that may have occurred. And then finally, that comes up with our final revenue estimate that then we produce and provide each quarter. So that's, in a very broad terms, the process that we go through. And then I'm going to turn it over to Michael, who's going to get into the more specific methodologies of the revenue forecast.
Good morning. For the record, Michael Kennedy with the Office of Economic Analysis. Mr. Chair,
good morning.
Members of the committee. First, I'd like to start off by overviewing a few terms that we use here, just so we're all clear on what we're talking about. In terms of personal income tax revenues, collections, we use that term for the dollars that actually come in the door to the state, and this is actually on a daily basis we're receiving these dollars. Now, these dollars are related to tax liability, which is how much Oregonians owe on income in a given tax year. So we use the term liability here a lot because it is the foundation for our forecast process. Now, on liability, we receive dollars from a variety of sources. We receive payments in advance of final tax filings, and those are estimated and advance payments. And withholding is a form of estimated payment then, just on wages and salaries. When the year is finally done, tax filings are prepared and Oregonians find that they owe money or get a refund. Final payments are dollars owed to the state above and beyond what they've already paid in. We term them delinquent if they're more than 2 years due. This is a very small fraction of all dollars, however. And refunds then are dollars owed to Oregonians if they've paid too much in for their estimated and advance payments. So right now I'm going to get into an overview of the personal income tax model constituting 87% of all general funds, this obviously is the most important model we work with. Just as a really broad overview, the system that we're actually trying to capture here and model begins with, obviously, the overall economy, which then impacts income of Oregonians. That, in turn, begets tax liability, given current tax law. And then at some point in time, we receive those dollars owed. So that's the general system. And the manner in which we go about forecasting that or modeling that system really is based on liability, how much Oregonians are going to owe in any given year. And we do that primarily with our income distribution model, which I'll talk more about in a second. But we take liability, and in fact, we use the distribution of income of Oregonians. We provide forecasts of that to the Legislative Revenue Office. They use the tax calculator, which basically estimates how much Oregonians would owe given that they're falling in various income brackets. We're then provided a total liability forecast, and then we use historical patterns of payments coming in to the state to translate that liability forecast into a collections forecast. And in other words, forecast the dollars we're going to get in any given fiscal period. For a little more detail on this liability estimates, we have an income distribution model. This is basically where we model how many Oregonians or how many tax filers are going to fall into various income brackets. And this is divided between single and married filers, given that they look very differently in terms of how much they owe and how they're distributed. And we break income up into 24 classes, ranging from negative income all the way up to $1 million or more. And we have historical data now for about the past two decades. And what we're trying to do is model how many Oregonians fall into each of these classes and then use that model to project future distributions. And in fact, we need to do this specifically because those distributions have been changing significantly over time with increases in income in general. And as you can see here, this is single filers, and the blue line is 1980, so we had predominantly most people down in the lower brackets. And that has since shifted with bracket creep to the tax year 2000 is the latest data we have. And you can see significantly more single filers falling in the lower middle to middle income brackets. Now, this is significantly more obvious when you talk about joint filers. And as you can see, there's been a significant move up the income scale. The jump up there in the middle is where the brackets go from about a $5,000 increment to $10,000. So that's the only reason there's a bump up there. It's just a broader bracket. Now, this has significant impact on our forecast because the top 10% of income earners in Oregon pay about 80% of the income tax. So small errors here up in, as where you can see these small numbers there in the top four or five brackets have significant impact over how, what our eventual liability forecast is going to be. So as I said, we run that forecast through and we provide the Legislative Revenue Office with that projection of number of filers. They use their tax calculator to determine how much they think those Oregonians would owe and give us back an annual liability forecast. Now, as I've said, there's small errors in those filer distributions can result in large differences in what the liability impact is going to be. So we also produce a separate forecast of liability that's based on economic factors, our forecast of the tax base, capital gains income, what the effective tax rate history has been, and we use that to produce a second measure so we can look side by side any market differences there, and that gives us a clue that there's something we need to look at further. But we combine both of those in one manner or another using our judgment to produce this final liability forecast. And that's the foundation of our personal income tax revenue forecast.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
There's an acronym that I'm not sure what it stands for, Mr. Co-Chair.
OYPTXB.
Oh, tax base.
Tax base?
Yes, that's It's a measure we have for the income. We have personal income tax forecasts, but not all components of personal income are taxable. And so we pare that down, add in a few other components not included in personal income that are taxable, such as capital gains and retirement income, and that produces what we think is the tax base or taxable income for Oregon.
Thank you.
Sorry about that, Representative.
Oh, no. Thank you, Coach.
So the question then is, when are we going to receive these dollars? This chart here shows how liability for a given year, here 2001, arrived. The green is withholding, and withholding constitutes the majority of the tax dollars that we receive. We also receive estimated payments on non-wage and salary income quarterly. And then after the tax year is over, we have a final reconciliation with tax filing, and we distribute refunds, the red, and the yellow is final payments made. So as I've just said, we take that annual liability forecast, and we translate that into monthly dollars. And then we use seasonal adjustment factors because there is significant seasonal variability in the dollars arriving to the state of Oregon. And then we project those out to when we think they're going to be received, and there's a fairly consistent pattern over history of liability to collections. And then we sum that up to be our quarterly forecast. And on top of that, then we add any add factors, anything we think the model is missing going forward, as well as all of the legislative changes that Legislative Revenue Office provides to us for tax changes that aren't already in the data we're using. And so that produces our collections forecast, which, as you can see historically and then going into the future, is represented here. And as I just said, we include final adjustments, including LRO's tax impacts. Now, the corporate income tax model is similar, so we don't need to spend too much time, but it's basically the same type of system. Economic variables are used to model and forecast what companies are going to owe in terms of tax liability. And then those tax liabilities are translated into quarterly collections based on historical patterns. Yeah, corporate income tax, the one caveat here is that they do not operate on a consistent tax year. Corporations actually get to pick their tax year, their fiscal year. They can pick any range of a date to a date. And that tax year is defined by the beginning year rather than the end year. So right now, you still have firms out there that are operating on their 2002 tax year. So it makes it a little more difficult. It's not as simple as personal income tax with a consistent year, as we'll see with the distribution of collections. So we take the liability, and we then translate that into how we think we're going to collect it in terms of advance payments throughout the year, plus final payments and refunds. And here you can see what that relationship looks like. So that for a given tax year, here this is 1998, you can see that we're receiving dollars on that tax year for over about a 3-year span of time. But this historical pattern here is used then to translate our liability forecast into a collections forecast. And we sum that up quarterly again. And we add on top of that any add factors we might think are appropriate, plus any legislative changes provided to us. And this produces our quarterly forecast for corporate income, which is then summed up and presented to you, to the Revenue Committee.
Maybe there's a reason as always, means not river.
Now, on top of that, once every biennium, we produce our May 15th forecast. That plus any legislative actions that have occurred during the regular session then becomes our close of session forecast, which is the benchmark upon which any kicker calculations are based. So how has the forecast performed over the past couple of decades? Well, as you can see here, this is the deviation of the actual revenues relative to the close of session forecast going back to the 81-83 biennium. Mm-hmm. Now, on average, it's about a 1.6% deviation. That is, collections have come in about 1.6% higher than the close of session forecast. Of course, that is a large number of excessive underestimations, offset by a couple of very large overestimations, most particular the current biennium. But what you see here is actually, in particular, look at 85-87 and 95-97. These are biennium following recessions, where you see that actually there is a tendency to undershoot based on recent taking basically the recent weakness and projecting it forward and having a tendency to come up quite short and initiate the two largest kicker payments in the past two decades. So our current forecast for this biennium is $9.2 billion, but we're projecting for the next biennium $10.9 billion. That is the growth deferred, the 18%. If I may just step in right there and remind everyone that we paid out $357 million in kicker refunds and federal pension refunds. Those are one-time payouts that exaggerate this difference significantly. If you adjust for that, because we won't be making those payments this next biennium, the actual growth between 0103 and 0305 is 13%, 13.6%. As you say, we have growth going forward. Here it is depicted graphically. So you can see that throughout the 90s, we had a significant pickup in the growth rate in general fund revenues. And that, of course, came to an end, an abrupt end, here in this biennium. But then we are projecting, again, consistent growth historically. And I have another graph here coming up that'll address that. But in terms of percentage changes, if you look at the past two decades, you can see the growth from biennium to biennium in general fund revenues. Now, this does not include kicker refunds because that tends to distort the picture. This is the true underlying structural receipts that we get to the general fund. You can see this biennium, we're down 7% from the previous biennium. We're projecting growth in the next biennium about 13.6%, and that is right on the 13.5% historical average over the past two decades.
Question?
Can we hold those, or is this a technical question? Representative Smith.
On your graph here, in 0103, you go from a negative 7 to the next year, a positive 13. Well, isn't that like a 20.6% growth over 1 year? Not a 13%.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, it is the number from this year, this biennium to next, is 13.6. It's not cumulative in that sense.
Okay, thank you.
Somehow it's a good observation.
You see then 15.5% in the following biennium. In fact, that's not only consistent with what we're seeing here, which tends to be that it takes a couple biennium from a recession to a high point of an economy, because the business cycle tends to be about 10 years long, but also there are a number of legislative tax law factors causing it to be higher in the next biennium, most particular the phase-out of the depreciation allowance in the federal law, which happens in 05. So a considerable amount of corporate tax liability has actually been shifted out from today, this biennium and next, into the subsequent biennium. So you've seen the growth rates we have, 13.6, 15.5, and here are a number of factors underlying our current forecast. First of and foremost is the economic recovery and the historical tendency for the economy to rebound off a recession. In fact, if a recession has brought us below what the long-run sustainable economic level is, then recovering to that level, and in some sense even having a return to economic viability, tends to make it look like a greater jump than it actually is relative to the historical trend. So we often do experience this rebound from a recession into the subsequent years. What are we going to say about personal income? Our personal income. Okay. Our personal income forecast, and actually I have, we might as well just get into that. Our personal income forecast, and this is from the economic forecast, is for a resumption of personal income growth at a historical trend, which has been about 6%. So you can see we experienced in 2002 calendar year only 2.5% growth, which was significantly off the long-term trend, and we are going to return to that over the next couple years, 2003, but even more strongly in 04, 05, and 06. So this is one of the factors underlying our personal income tax forecast. In addition, personal income does not include some of our key components of taxable income, most importantly capital gains and retirement income. And those two categories have been growing greater than overall gross income in Oregon. And you can see one of the issues here has been the capital gains forecast and how variable it is. From year to year, that's what's introducing a considerable amount of the volatility in our personal income tax forecast. Retirement income is going to become more and more important just with the demographic changes we're experiencing with an aging population and with the baby boomers on the brink, basically, of all becoming retired and increasing that source of income even more in terms of its importance. And finally, even with that income growth, there's also the fact that the effective tax rate has been climbing over the past two decades. And that is a result of that bracket creep that you could see earlier in those income distribution models. So as Oregonians have climbed up the income scale, their overall effective rate relative to whichever measure of income you want has been going up. So all of those combined are basically the underlying factors for our personal income tax forecast. What you're looking at here is we've seen now that the late 90s, the stock market bubble, and other factors were basically a temporary phenomenon. And what we experienced here was a significant correction. If you go back before the late 90s, if you go back to about 1992, and you look at the history of personal income tax, there's about between a 7 and 8% growth rate per year. Now, if you take just that 7% rate, which is actually on the low end of growth over that period, and you project that out, trying to get some sense of a long-term trend in personal income tax revenue growth, what you get is that yellow dashed line, and up next to that is our current forecast of personal income tax revenue. So you can see here that we return to that long-term trend only in about 2004, 5, and 6 as the economy recovers and resumes normal growth. Now we are constantly, as Tom said, one of our objectives is to try to narrow the error around actual revenues that we experience, and so we are constantly working on ways to improve our forecasting process. If you want to overview these,
yeah, just briefly on these, we're Working actually with Legislative Revenue Office is assisting us. We're trying to come up with a possible creation of a technical advisory group for the revenue forecast, in addition to our use of the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors. We're also looking into developing a leading indicator model. One of the hardest things to forecast is turning points. And they can happen very, very rapidly. Most of the past recessions have pushed us into the situation in less than two quarters. So these happen very, very quickly, and that's very difficult when you're trying to forecast over a two-year period of time. So we hope that may give us some more insight. We're also working with the Department of Revenue and Legislative Revenue Office to update our filer distribution model that Michael went into some detail, especially the aspect of what's going on in those higher income brackets that pay quite a bit of taxes. And we're also trying to develop a better relationship between our personal income measures that we have and how that translates into the taxable income models.
All right. Thank you very much. Good presentation. I think we have perhaps more than a few questions. We'll start with Senator Winters.
Thank you. Just a couple questions, and one you had mentioned under delinquent payments that was a small amount. Could you tell us what percentage that is and if that percentage has gone up during this recessionary period?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters. The percentage, I don't have the exact number, but it's in the range of a tenth of 1% or even less than that. I mean, we receive 99.9% of all tax revenue on a given tax year within 2 years, a year in progress plus the subsequent year. And it has not changed pretty much in the last two decades.
So there hasn't been an appreciable increase in that delinquent payment as a result of the recession?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, I think what you see is as recessions happen and the longer that people are out of work and have problems, they dig into their savings and everything else, and then they come into a situation where one of the last things they want to do is be delinquent on things like taxes or house payments and things like that. So I think when we start to see our final payments coming in this 2003, this is where we may start, if it is going to show up a little bit more, this is where we might see it happen.
My second question is that you talked about the bubble and the recession and that we're now beginning to pull out. Was one of the factors that when you did your analysis, the factor of 9/11, which is an event that was not foreseen, and what that implication was in the recession?
Senator Winters, 9/11 had basically a temporary effect on us. If you look in terms of personal income and a number of other factors, we basically rebounded from that within a month or two. And the much larger impact on Oregon in terms of tax revenues was just the recession itself beginning in 2001, and then the delaying of the recovery, which has pretty much come down to the events in the stock market recently, including all of the corporate misdeeds and subsequent market instability. Both of those had a significant impact.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, also at this time, most economists were wondering whether we actually were in recession or not, as we were at just before 9/11. And in fact, the gross domestic product measures that we use for the overall U.S. economy were still positively estimated at that time. It wasn't until they were revised last year for the year 2001 that we saw our three consecutive negative quarters. And then definitely what was suspected as recession definitely was there.
Other questions? Senator Messer.
Mr. Chair, a comment first and then a question. As I look over your graphs, it seems to me that the model itself is really lacking when you get in the recessionary type period or the revenue losses. And I'm wondering, I guess it would be a question if you, and you have indicated that you are looking at setting up some new boards or whatever to review that and to review the model. But my main question I'm interested in is that when you look at your projections for the coming year, and I'm quite concerned about the 18% growth that we're projecting, if you consider the loss of infrastructure, and I'm thinking of our many of our industries, the plants are gone or shut down, as in food processing, forest products processing, those kind of factors that I would think would have a huge impact on how we can recover. But also the loss of markets, because those plants that are down, many worldwide have picked up markets in other countries. The regulatory process and the impact that is going to have on many of these industries coming back, the potential for a war, and as was mentioned earlier by Senator Winters, the possibility of future terrorist attacks.
Mr. Chair, Senator Mesler, yes, all those things are worrisome. Especially the possibility of a terrorist attack, yes, all bets would be off on the forecast. We have worked into our forecast that we'll be putting out March 1, the scenario of a war with Iraq and the implications that would have on the economy. Of course, spillover effects for all states, you know, in the U.S. The scenario we have for that is a war that is over fairly quickly, so that there is a short-term impact occurring, but then bouncing back out of that quite quickly. In fact, some analysts believe that the uncertainty of whether we have war or not with Iraq is probably causing more problems right now in the markets than if actually some action was taken. That's with about a 60% probability that we believe that sort of scenario will occur. Your other scenarios that possibly could occur is you also have a war with Iraq, but it's very long and drawn out. If that's the case, then that also is very problematic. Some of your other points, regulatory process, loss of markets, loss of infrastructure. Yes, when you go through recessionary periods, these are some of the consequences. Firms that were possibly just getting started or were struggling a little bit even before the recession happened, those are the ones that generally go under. We've had a lot of consolidation, especially in the food processing area. At the same token, there's still some bright spots out there. I last week gave a talk in Boardman. And the Lamb Weston area, that facility seems to be not doing too bad, and they're rather encouraged about some of their exports for crops. The value of the U.S. dollar has slowly been coming down, and that's encouraging for our manufacturing sector. High tech, I think, is still in place and still going to be an engine of growth for at least the next 5 years. So we believe that once that bounce back happens, that will also be helpful to us, too. So we're more inclined to believe that the structure of the Oregon economy is not that dramatically different than it was just 2 years ago, so that it will still come out as the recession abates and we get into a out of this jobless recovery and into a job-making recovery.
Senator Morris?
This is a more of a technical question. Where do you include your S-Corp tax revenue? In personal or corporate?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, they are in the personal income tax.
Do you have an idea of what tax percentage of the personal revenue is driven by the S-Corp?
The information we get, I think, has those lumped together with a few other things. They all show up on the same schedule. So it's tough to elicit exactly what those are. This actually does get at part of the point here where what's driving a lot of our personal income tax growth are those aspects that are not in the personal income measure, basically non-wage and salary earnings, including those S-Corp, the retirement again, the capital gains, areas where we need to do better, because those are the things that fluctuate significantly and particularly in a downturn and are driving a greater volatility in our tax revenues than in the overall economy.
From a public perception, by lumping the S-Corp into personal earnings, it creates a false illusion on the part of the public when they look at the distribution of liability or support from personal to corporate. It seemed to me to distinguish within that personal revenue category.
That's an excellent point. And as we talk, we're constantly working with legislative revenue and the Department of Revenue. That would be a point going forward that I would continue to look at.
Mm-hmm. Senator Harper has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for today. We have a governor's budget based upon an 18% growth, which is your estimate, today's estimate. You have a worst-case scenario and a best-case scenario. Do we have that information someplace, Tom, that we can just have in our box?
Mr. Chair, Senator Harper, we don't have that explicitly available, but we can give that to you. There's a rough rule of thumb here that you're probably going to move about 6% around a biennium. So based on where our forecast is, about 6% up or below that.
I guess Teresa had a little bullet in her briefing that, you know, she had $700 million as a worst case. Is that...
Well, that comes in, you know, if you're looking at close to about a $10 billion and you take 6%, you get $600 million. So somewhere right around that area.
So plus or minus 6 would be...
Yes.
...what you would suggest we use. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chair, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Mr. Chair for yesterday.
That's right. Demoted since Friday. When you talk with all the experts, one of the things I'm and develop your forecast, I'm struck by the fact that there's a discussion going on in Washington, D.C. with respect to the president's economic stimulus package, whether it's getting rid of the double taxation on dividends, getting rid of the death tax, accelerating the tax cuts that are to be phased in the future. Do you, and I, at least as I witness that debate, there is bipartisan agreement, I would suggest, on the notion that reducing the tax burden stimulates the economy. It's an argument over how much are you going to do it, because both parties say we're going to provide a tax cut for this group or that group, and they haven't figured that out, which group is going to get it. On the contrary, is here in Oregon, we seem to be driven by some who suggest that increasing tax rates will somehow benefit our economy. How do you square all of these different propositions in your forecast?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative Miller, not easily.
You wait until the bill is passed, in other words? I mean, when you see discussion in Washington, D.C., do you say, well, 6 months from now we'll have to we'll see how that works?
We have from our National Forecasting Service and their outlook for the U.S. economy, which are some of the drivers in our model, they will work in what they believe is a likely outcome of a tax package. Now, they won't know exactly, who's going to get what out of what bill will be passed, but most likely there's going to be some sort of stimulus-type package, a combination of tax rates cuts, possibly more spending, but some combination of that that's going to help spur the economy. And the federal government can do that because they can deficit spend. Unfortunately, at the state level and local levels, because of constitutional amendments, the budget has to be balanced. And in essence, you're stuck between a rock and a hard place. If you cut spending at the state level, and we have a mixed economy, the government is part of the economy, as the private sector is, that spending is a reduction than what was planned, and that will be a drag on the economy. If you raise taxes instead of cut the spending, well, this also takes away income from businesses, from households, just to replace what would have been cut in the spending. Likewise, that's a drag on the economy. So the discussion here about whether it's beneficial or not, I think, has to go into some very deep theoretical issues. Are you talking about short-run fixes? Are you worried about long-run fixes or long-run problems? I think the issue right now is a discussion of, for example, K-12. If they are cut further, what is the long-run consequences of that, as opposed to short-run consequences? Likewise, if taxes are raised, does this send a message out to other places, businesses that say, well, every time that they have a problem, they simply raise their taxes? Is this a place we want to be at? So there are arguments on both sides here. You can go either way. The one logical argument that you cannot, I don't think, refute is that no matter what direction you go in, because of this recession that has happened, because of this financial bubble that burst, you're in a situation where you have to balance a budget. No matter which way you move, it's going to be a partial drag on the economy.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Senator Schrager, I suppose I could call on. I'm getting used to calling you that. Somewhat difficult. A lot of the questions I had and wanted to ask have already been answered, but I want to flesh a couple of things out real quickly if we could. I've had the privilege to attend several revenue forecasts at the federal level back in Washington, D.C. in the last couple of months. The message I got there was we may be going in the direction you pointed to, but the major question was how volatile it's going to be and how predictable is it. And the sense I got it was going to be potentially very volatile and potentially unpredictable. For all the reasons Senator Messerly has pointed out, as well as oil crisis and several other things. And I would ask that you potentially step back and look at some of those figures you've thrown out, that plus or minus 6% may not be accurate. We just went through a 16% lack of forecast being correct. And it affected five special sessions, obviously. And we well could go through that again. And we might want to prepare ourselves for the potential of more special sessions after we close, if the economy is as volatile as we might think it might be. And I would appreciate that information. The other question I had was the one you just partially answered. That's the effect on the economy of the state of Oregon. Oregon's about 1% of the national economy. The state government is one of the major drivers of our economy, though, and something we do have control over. And we potentially may be walking away from a lot of federal matching funds that goes into our economy, $500-600 million a year. We don't always hire and buy locally. We buy from outside the state for some of our road projects. Is there any way of forecasting or determining not buying locally and walking away from large federal matches, what it will do to the economy in Oregon itself? Is there any way of assessing that kind of damage?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, on that second part, there's some aspects of being able to do that. There are these economic impact type analysis that are done at a very micro level of spending multipliers. You know, if you would spend them first here rather than spend them out of state. At the same time, we have a question of if buying in state the best possibility to do so, because they really don't have any specialty in the particular service or product that's needed by the state, the price could be 40% higher than out of state. And by buying it out of state, you now have this extra money that could be spent in state for something else. I mean, so there are questions that go back and forth on that one as to the efficiency of state dollars and whether it would be best in state or out of state. Your first part of your question, could you repeat that for me, please?
First part of the question related primarily to how volatile
we're
going to be in the economy and whether or not the parameters we're putting on this is wide enough and whether we should be prepared to possibly come back, unfortunately, and try to rebalance.
Representative Bates, yes, I think that is something that we will take another look at in terms of those boundaries. You want to keep in mind recessions are generally the exception through economic business cycles rather than the norm. We tend to have much longer periods of expansionary periods compared to contractionary. So we're also doing that boundary more on an average we might see over time. The possibility there is that, of course, if you want to do that for the worst possible scenario possible, then you would pick out what has been the worst time, which this is rapidly approaching, and put that as your parameter for volatility. You know, my colleagues in other states, when we talk about our forecasting problems, and we all mention about the difficulties, they always like to mention back that they're so glad they're not the forecaster in Oregon. Because of our tax structure, the personal income tax, very volatile tax, more so than the other tax forms, it does complicate the job of doing this.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm referring to page 16 of your presentation, Tom, and then I'm looking also back on page 23 of the BAM analysis, where Senator Harper has indicated that the low side of this would be $700 million down from the December forecast. But it says the December 2002 forecast still assumes a recovery rate of 18%. Now, as I look at the anticipated growth, it shows 13.6. Is that the difference? You're estimating 13.6, and the governor has added 5% to that. Is that what we have here by projecting an 18% growth?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, the difference there is that we are not including kicker and pension refunds in this calculation here, because they distort the picture. They make that 18% more than it really is. 13.6 is what we are predicting for the difference in revenues from biennium to biennium. But we distributed $357 million this biennium out one time that then makes the difference look larger than it actually is. So it's distorted by the fact that we paid out that $357 million. So those are revenues we had in pocket that we actually made this biennium. But then we turned around and we handed them back out. So the difference in structural, what the economy is generating in terms of tax revenue, is 13.6% between this biennium and the next.
And Mr. Chair, or Mr. Co-Chair, do I understand that the budget then, and this isn't a question necessarily for Mr. Petoskey and Mr. Kennedy, but the budget has been based upon an 18% projected increase?
We need to get Teresa to give us an accurate, or perhaps Mr. Rocco, but I suspect it's the same 18% that Mr. Kennedy's talking about. It's actually a 13% increase. As we understand this here today, as it's presented to us, the actual increase is not 18% in terms of new revenues. It's actually 13%.
Okay.
And if I may summarize just from my understanding, I'm trying to be comfortable with this, and I think that you see our panel here struggling with this, and I appreciate the presentation, but if I was to summarize, the reason it's going to be a 13%, well, it's 18 only because of the refunds with the kicker. So it's actually 13%. And the reason you think it's going to be a 13% turnaround, which I still think is pretty healthy given the current status of where we are right now, is that we're going to experience this rebound effect actually we will see some increases, and they'll appear more steep than one might expect just because we're down so far. And that a lot of the corporate money will have a significant influx of corporate money because of the deferral of corporate income that's occurred at the federal level. And then also this bracket creep, you expect that to continue also. So if I put all those factors into that, I'm thinking, little country veterinarian from Canby, that the actual increase perhaps then in hard turnaround in manufacturing and assets and all that is probably not really total of 13%. It's showing all these other factors in there too that make it look like it's a larger increase than actual. Okay. Yes, Representative Johnson, and then Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Petoskey, in looking at your economic modeling, you went through all of the different sources of information that you get. Do you rely on any of the information that's put out by the Federal Reserve in terms of predicting national growth, and how your projection might compare with any of the numbers offered by the Fed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, we do take a look at the Fed's outlook. They come out with a wonderful publication called the Beige Book that surveys various sectors throughout the U.S. and, of course, the Federal Reserve 12th District that we're located in. We use that information with the... And I guess what I'd say is when we meet with the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors, we get that information, we use that. We have, of course, our forecasting service that we use. We also use something called the Blue Chip Forecast Consensus, which is a list of about 40 different forecasters throughout the country and what their view is on various measures of the economy and what their consensus forecast would be from that group. So we do use other input besides just the forecast service that we
subscribe. What's the Fed's projection for the national growth rate?
I don't know that off the top of my head, Representative Johnson. I know it's fairly close to what our Global Insight is, the group that we use, which is, I think, gross domestic product of about 1.3% for 2003, and then growing above 3% in 2004.
Senator Devlin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just two questions, actually. When we look at our growth and revenue that's projected, obviously we're looking at a reference point. And if we looked at the end of session, if we use that as a reference point, we would still have less revenue in this next biennium than we had at the end of session in the last biennium. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, that is correct. Of the 11 point, whatever the number.
About 11.5. 11.4. That was 11.9.
In 0305, we're projecting now 10.9. And we were at 11.1 for this biennium, was the initial close of session. So, yeah, we have not returned to that initial expectation, and do not until 0507 do we exceed.
Secondly, one of the things that was cited in the decline in state revenues in terms of income taxes is the decline in capital gains. Is there any evidence that capital gains are coming back? And if they are, is it a different makeup than we had prior to the recession of where they're coming from?
Senator Devlin, our latest information right now is for tax year 2001. It takes the Department of Revenue about a year to process tax returns to get a look at what income looked like for the previous year. So we're just about to get good information on 2001. And the decline there was from about $6 billion in 2000 to $2.5 billion. In 2001. Our projection is for very slow growth from there, basically flat into 2002 because of what we've seen in the stock market, and very slow growth, more in line with the trend far before the 90s boom. But the problem there is that you really don't know what's happened in terms of gains, particularly because it's a behavioral phenomenon that you decide to realize a gain or not, so there's not always clear information about what's going to precipitate taxpayers to realize a gain or not. And so it's usually a year, 2 years after the fact that we actually see what was going on with capital gains. It's probably going to be, it's the most difficult component there to work with.
Thank you.
Representative Patrick.
Realizing generally that people took a lot of large capital losses last year, have you changed your model to deal with the capital loss carry forward into the next biennium? Have you taken that into account in the budget projections you gave us? Because we had such volatility in the capital gains. I mean, that was one of our largest volatile items during this last biennium. Have you taken that into account when you've provided these new projections? And if so, can maybe you explain a little bit how you took that into account?
Senator, Mr. Chair, Representative Patrick. We've taken into account in the sense of what our forecast is going forward. About the best we know is what capital gains look like in 2001 currently, and which we've realized in the last month or so. And so using that as our baseline and assuming that there will be loss carry forwards, that's the reason why we don't have much growth worked in to capital gains for the next couple of years.
So Paul, so what you're telling me, though, is because we don't know what happened in 2002, we really haven't accounted for what I think are going to be substantial capital loss carry forwards as a result of this revenue forecast?
Representative Patrick, as I look at 2001 and think in terms of taxpayers out there basically experiencing the majority of their losses in 2001 and wondering there, and those were experienced late in the year, there was the capacity there to exercise those losses at a point in time when cash flow was pretty much a major problem there in October, November, December of 2001. And so the question is really, why would the losses carried forward be greater than the losses that were exercised already in the year in which they were actually incurred and could be used against significant capital gains for the first half of the year? And so the question, basically in finding out that capital gains were $2.5 billion instead of the $1 billion that we'd been thinking they were for the last 6 months, the rationale becomes you can see why we wouldn't experience much growth, but it's hard to say why capital gains would be much lower than they were in basically the worst year of this stock market decline. That's been our rationale in terms of not having a further reduction. And we do reduce the capital gains forecast 10% in 2002. It is lower. And then we bring it back basically to the same level as in 2001 in 2003.
Okay. Along the lines of Representative Patrick's question, I assume that the new model or the refinement of the model will attempt to get at predicting capital gains more accurately, or is that even remotely possible given its volatile nature and the fact we don't get a separate form?
Mr. Chair, we've tried to model after the U.S. Congressional Budget Office has a model of capital gains, which over time has performed rather poorly. And it is just—it is a very, very difficult item to forecast, especially as Michael was mentioning. Not only do we have to take into account things like what the stock market, for example, might be doing, but also people's behavior. And even as Representative Patrick mentioned about the loss carryover, here it is also difficult to get a good handle on, so we also get a little better information as what actually happened. And two, just getting an idea of the size of what some of the capital losses were. You know, the rule of thumb here is that the time you take a capital gain is when you can get a capital loss. And so dollar for dollar, those people that got out of the market took large capital gains. They could offset them, and that's a much better offset than taking the small amount, the carryover. So we think probably people did a lot of that in the tax year, and that's what really brought the capital gains revenues down even further than what the market fell.
So if I may then, it would seem to me if capital gains has been our biggest problem in terms of revenue in this recession, and it's impossible to really predict it any more accurately because of the behavioral factors and all these things, the chance of us refining this model so that there's less biennial deviation, even though you're accurate over the 20-year span, we have to budget over a biennial span, and it sounds like we're not going to really improve that probably a whole bunch. Is that be accurate?
I would say that's probably accurate, yes, sir.
Last question. Then I guess the obvious question for us would be, well, gee, you know, is there another model out there? Are there other economic, nothing personal, are there other economic models, outfits that are doing modeling of Oregon's revenue forecasts that have been more accurate than ours?
Mr. Chair, another outfit that we get some information from is called economy.com. They have modeled some of these aspects for each of the states. And as far as we could tell, their forecast out to the near future was much too optimistic for capital gains compared with what we saw our own experience. So there are other approaches out there. I would say when it comes to capital gains, you're like the good forecast is like the old trick when you're a investor writing a newsletter. And you send out two newsletters, one that says the market's going up, the other that says it's going down. And then if it actually went up, then that group you send two letters to. And then finally, as you write to that last select group, then that's who you get the money from.
Well, along, spinning it just slightly, just trying to get clarity here. Given Oregon's very volatile tax situation, you made it very clear that the reason Oregon forecasters have much greater difficulty than other states is because of our huge dependence on income tax. Given that fact at this point in time, though, outside of just the capital gains sector, historically, retrospectively, have there been other outfits, either at the federal level or private concerns or consulting groups, that have predicted Oregon's revenues more accurately than this office?
Mr. Chair, I would say no. I think that the record for the office is fairly decent. There have, of course, it's over a two-year period of time, which does make it a little more difficult than having to just do each fiscal year, as some other states have to can do. So I would not say that there's necessarily a better model out there than what we're using. But not to say that we can't also use some return.
Sure. Other questions? We theoretically also have Mr. Warner scheduled to talk for a little bit, and I'm not sure when everyone wants to leave this particular room. So, why don't we have Mr. Warner come up quickly? Is there the sense of the committee, how much longer do you want to persist here today?
Well, only that we have 4:30.
So we can't go past 11:30, eh?
So do we.
Alrighty. Well, then, I know Paul's used to talking very quickly and concisely, so we shouldn't have much trouble fitting it into the next 15 minutes. Okay. Would that be possible, Paul?
Oh, sure.
Thank you guys very much. Appreciate your help. I'm not sure we feel a lot better, but at least we understand what the lay of the land is.
Mr. Chair, I do have a presentation termed Oregon's Revenue Situation. That should be in your material. Mr. Chair, my technical expert will
put in my... We're really interested.
He's come a long way.
I'm Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Officer, and essentially the material I have for you in front of you today is the material we've provided the House Revenue Committee and their orientation. So it's really a discussion of the revenue situation, taking a little broader perspective, a little bit more of a historical perspective, and building on a number of things that Office of Economic Analysis talked about. I think it's important to look back at the structural change that our system has undergone, our revenue system has undergone over the last 10 years. I think that that explains a number of the things that you're confronting now in terms of your budget deliberations. If you go back to the 1990s and talk about the prelude, as I call it, which would be my second slide there, I think there's a number of things that occurred in the 1990s that have made particularly those numbers in terms of the 16% drop you've looked at in general fund revenue that put this into perspective. Well, the first, of course, is Measure 5, which centralized our revenue system considerably by reducing property tax revenue. The search for alternative revenue in the 1990s was a search that really moved our finance system away from taxes as a source of revenue. I think it's important to keep that in mind as you look at general fund and compare that with the other kinds of revenue sources that are available. And finally, the economic boom, particularly the boom in the stock market that created distortions that you've already seen. If you look at the next overhead, I think this is probably the chart that explains the change in our revenue system better than anything else. It shows the historical change, an extended period throughout our history where property taxes were always the largest source of revenue in the system, largest source of tax revenue in Oregon's system. That changed in 92-93 as Measure 5 was being phased in. And although Measure 5 did not provide the property tax relief for a lot of residential property owners that was anticipated, and that led, of course, to Measure 50 eventually. But you can see that raw property tax collections over the period of phase-in for Measure 5, remember Measure 5 was a rate limit, not a value limit, property tax collections declined 12% over that period in dollar terms between 90-91 and 95-96. You can also see that the blip up that occurred in the 96-97 property tax year, that was the first year, really the only year, in which we operated under the Measure 5 rate limits but no value limit. So that was a 12% increase that essentially eliminated the 5 years of decline in 1 year due to value growth.
Well, of course, those bills arrived in people's mailboxes a couple of weeks before Measure 47 was voted on. And it was probably one of the key factors in support behind Measure 47, which became Measure 50. You can see there that the rollback provision in Measure 50 lowered collections by about 2%. And since that time, they've grown pretty steady at around 5%. Value growth over the past year from January 1 of 01 to January 1, 02, and the resulting revenues that are coming in now, showed a value growth of 4.1% statewide. There are some counties that grew slower than that. Multnomah, for example, 1.5%. But I think the lesson here is that the Measure 50 property tax system is pretty stable, particularly when you contrast that with the fluctuations you're seeing now in the personal income tax. If you look at the personal income tax, you can see the very rapid growth that occurred in the 1990s, and this is not due to any change in policy. In fact, there were some things that eroded the base. These numbers have kicker refunds in them. So you can see the collections grew dramatically throughout the 1990s until the past fiscal year, the 01-02 fiscal year, where they dropped 17%. So this is essentially the general fund situation that you're confronting. One of the things that I think is helpful in seeing the changes brought about by Measure 5 is to look at the census data. The census data shows up here in what's called general revenue. General revenue is all state and local revenue, with the exception of trust fund revenue, which is public employees' retirement system, workers' compensation trust fund, and also government enterprises. OLCC wouldn't be in this. Utilities owned by local governments. But it's a very broad, comprehensive measure of revenue. And census categorized revenue from four sources. Taxes are just one of those sources. And you can see that taxes for 89-90 on the eve of Measure 5 were 54% of general revenue for Oregon. Now you compare that with the 99-2000 latest census data we got just actually a couple of weeks ago. It's 57% for the state and local system nationally. So our 89-90 system looked a lot more like the national system does today than our current system. And you can see our system changed. Our taxes as a percentage of general revenue declined from 54 to 45% over that 10-year period. What has jumped has been our federal revenue, and some of it clearly due to work of this committee and leveraging federal dollars. But it jumped from 20 to 25%, and now you can see that our reliance on federal revenue is well above the national average, 25% of our general revenue versus 19 nationally. Another area of growth has been charges. This includes tuition, for example, system development charges, local government charges would be in here. They've jumped from 13 to 18% of general revenue. And miscellaneous revenue has been relatively flat, but it's declined nationally. And the reason is that the largest component of miscellaneous revenue is interest earnings. And interest earnings have been lower for all state and local governments because rates are lower. But Oregon's has not declined as much because miscellaneous revenue includes lottery. And, of course, the introduction of video poker occurred in 91, and that pushed up our lottery revenue considerably. Now, actually, we look at lottery revenue as a percent of general revenue. We have the highest percentage in the country in lottery revenue. So if you look at our revenue system now and kind of compare it with other states, you can see we really stand out in a lot of ways that I think for a lot of voters and citizens are hard to explain some of the differences you see. For example, if you look at our general revenue as a percentage of the total resident personal income, that same personal income number that Tom was talking about earlier, is 23%. The nation, it's about 20%. We rank 90 in 99-2000. Now, keep in mind, this is 99-2000, and it's, as I say, it's relatively speaking hot off the press from the census, but it's also the peak year of the economic boom.
So it doesn't, it's not picking up any of the decline. Notice that our tax burden is actually 39th among the states. We're a relatively low tax state. That's the change that occurred in the 90s. In 89-90, we ranked 13th in our tax burden. So what's happened is these other sources of revenue have grown to hold up general revenue while taxes have declined. Now, of course, the other unique feature about Oregon's system is the differences in our components of taxes. Our personal income tax burden, when people say Oregon is a high tax state, well, they're usually referring to the personal income tax, where our burden is the second highest in the country. And a number of years in the 90s, we were number one. We seem to trade off with New York. Our corporate income tax burden is about average, and that, again, fluctuates a lot, although it's a relatively small number. Our consumption tax burden, and here I'm using not only the retail sales tax, which is about 2.5% of personal income nationally, but also selective sales taxes like cigarettes, gas, beer and wine, other things that are taxed by the states. But you can see even when we include the other states, Alaska, Montana, Delaware, and New Hampshire, that don't have a general retail sales tax, we still have the lowest consumption tax burden. We rank 50th among the states. The biggest change in the 90s was our property tax ranking. We were fifth in property tax burden in 89-90, and with its 99-2000 data, we were 25th, right in the middle. So that's the change in the 90s from a high property tax state to an average property tax state. We track how Oregon's tax burden is distributed. And this, of course, reflects the chart you saw earlier on the personal income tax. And one of the reasons why it's difficult to predict is the proportion of revenue coming from that high income group. You can also see that adds a progressive element. But if you're talking about equity and distribution of the tax burden in Oregon, you need to look at all the taxes, and that's what we try to do in terms of the OTIM model that we have that distributes all taxes by income class. We do have a regressive tail at the low-income range, really caused by the property tax, because we assume that the renters pay property tax on commercial property that's residential. We assume that the portion of the property tax that's for restaurants and other what we call domestic businesses shows up in consumer prices, and the elderly have a very high home ownership rate. The rest of the tax burden, with the exception of the progressive tail at the end, is essentially proportional. And this is different than most states. Most states have a regressive tax structure because the sales tax tends to be predominant, and this is especially true in Washington, for example. There are trade-offs between stability and progressivity. The more progressive your tax system is, the more unstable it is. Now, if we look at what's happened to general fund in the 90s, general fund revenue growth was about 112%, driven by growth in the personal income tax. You can see our personal income over that period grew a little over 80%. This is what economists call elasticity. You divide the revenue by the change in income, and you can see you have an elasticity there of really about 1.4 or so. It's a very elastic system. Also keep in mind what Michael had said earlier, that personal income number doesn't include capital gains, but it shows up as tax collection. You can also see, and I think this has been one of the biggest factors that's been most difficult in the forecasting process, is when we get into these different kinds of price environments. In the early 80s, for example, one of the things that caused the forecasters to overshoot on revenue so much was they assumed inflation would continue, as it had in the late 70s and early 80s. But it didn't. It dropped dramatically in the early 80s and stayed lower. We also seem to be moving into virtually a stable price environment now. In fact, to the point where the Federal Reserve's policy really is to try to increase the inflation rate, which is a dramatic change from where we've been historically. In that kind of environment where there's virtually no inflation, you have stable prices, you can get these downturns in dollars collected that we hadn't seen in the past. But notice, if we look over just over the past decade, inflation has been much lower than income growth. So you look at a low inflation environment, you think revenue is going to be coming in slower,
course, it didn't in the 90s. If you look at the capital gains, and this of course you've talked about a good deal, and you can see those numbers that Michael referred to, that capital gains, when I came back to the Northwest in 1989 and was forecasting revenue, I spent very little time with capital gains. It wasn't a big deal. It was around $1 billion a year. It's interesting, but not something that really fluctuated very much. It didn't explain very much in terms of revenue growth. And you can see how that changed in the 90s, so that by the end of the decade, we're at $6 billion reported on income tax returns. I think the key issue in terms of capital gains is you had 3 years in the 90s with a Dow increasing over 20% a year. That had never happened. It had never happened. So you had no historical basis for that. You follow that with the last 3 years in which the Dow has declined, and the last time that happened was in 1939, 40, and 41. So it's been a while. And so the question as we look ahead for the volatility of the revenue system and predictability of it is this just a one-off kind of event that we're not going to see again, or are we in a period where capital gains are going to play a bigger part in how earnings are generated, how income is generated, and therefore where revenue comes from. One of the things I did was try to look at how much money we got from the stock market bubble in terms of general fund revenue. So I took the 1980s average as a percent of income, and that 1980s average represented a reasonably good period for the stock market. And I compared that with what we actually got in 99-01, above the trend average. It was $670 million. So $670 million in that biennium alone, that's basically what you, 0103, no longer have. And I think as you look ahead into the future years, you're probably not going to come back to anywhere near that level. The other thing that really jumped in the 90s was corporate profits. Of course, that's tied to the strength of the stock market. And you can see that corporate revenue went above $700 million, whereas it was around $300 million in 91-93. One of the things that again, as you look back or as you look ahead and ask, what is the normal period here? On corporate revenue, in 79-80, we reached a peak we did not return to again until 92-93. So it was almost a 15-year period before we had gotten back up to the 79-80 level in corporate collections. So you can go an extended period of very weak corporate earnings. Now, in terms of the current period, I think one of the things that's been very difficult, I think, to explain, and one of the things that has made the forecasting extremely difficult, is the economy, the recession, by all the historical norms, is mild. And you can see that if you look at the next slide here. This is taken from Tom's office. And if you look at the early 1980s, job losses over 10% in some quarters compared to the prior year. So huge losses in employment throughout the state, metro area, rural areas throughout the state. Now look at the job losses in the current recession, about 2%. Yet the revenue losses in percentage terms have been about the same. So there's a real disconnect there. And again, this raises the issue, are we in a different period in terms not so much of economic instability, but rather revenue instability? And I think the revenue piece gets back to those components of income where they're going to fluctuate a lot more than employment does, which for the economy is good. I mean, that's a positive for the economy, not to see the fluctuations in employment. But in terms of planning and budgeting and revenue decisions, it's something you're going to have to be better prepared to deal with in terms of the future, that volatility looks to be something, as Representative Bates was talking about, mm-hmm. something that may well be with us mm-hmm. for a while. Again, just the numbers that you've seen on the 0102, the decline was 17.4%. You can see the forecast was basically to break even with the prior year with those kicker pensions going out, kicker refunds, yet we got about $933 million less.
This, again, is something that Michael has put together and trying to evaluate the reasons for the reductions in revenue. And the biggest factor, of course, has been the capital gains, but also these other business sources of income. Senator Morris mentioned the S-Corps. They're only about 3% of income, but they fluctuate a good deal. And things like proprietor's income, partnership income, other types of investment income, dividend income dropped 22%. Last year compared to the prior year. So we're seeing the investment income component and the business income components really leading to the volatility, whereas wages are relatively flat, but even wages have become more volatile because there's much greater use of bonuses to pay workers, particularly in the high-tech sector. So what we're seeing is in the high-tech sector you see a drop-off in revenue, not from unemployment, but because those bonuses are not being paid out, and the state is pretty much picking up 9%, the top marginal rate on all those bonuses when the economy was doing well and the bonuses were being paid out. So that's where you're seeing the revenue losses, is of those types of income sources, more than kind of the traditional recession we had in the early 80s, where an unemployed timber worker isn't paying taxes because they're not receiving the wages. In terms of the current projection, you can see in some context, it's 8.4% revenue drop. That's unprecedented in the post-war period. We've never had a period, even the early 80s, we didn't see a drop of that magnitude. Corporate is a big reason for that. This is the same chart I had earlier, only it's showing the latest 0103 projection. Last year, corporate revenue dropped 47%. And you can see that we're back really to where we were almost 10 years ago in terms of corporate revenue. One of the things we do is track the overall tax revenue by state, and you can see that if you look at the different components of revenue, there's a real difference in this particular recession. If you go back to 01 and think about the 01 regular session, and you look at that green bar there on personal income taxes, as you're in session at that time, nationally personal income taxes had grown 10% compared to the prior year. Second quarter, those returns are coming in. Last good year of the stock market, they're up about 8%. So those are the numbers that the forecasters were looking at in the spring of 01 when that close of session was done. You can see some hint clearly that corporate, by the corporate revenue stream, that something was going on, that a recession was beginning to develop. Corporate revenue was down nationally, and you can see the big drops, over 30% by the end of 01 on a year-over-year basis. You can also see how the personal income tax situation deteriorated nationally, so that by the time the biennium began, personal income taxes were softening considerably across the country, and that by the first part of 2002, as those returns were coming in for the 2001 tax year, the drops are significant. The 2002 second quarter compared to the prior year, which is the big quarter for income tax collections, were down 22% nationally. Oregon was pretty close to that. It's interesting to look at the sales tax, which has been about even throughout this period. Sales taxes tend to be a more stable source of revenue. One thing, they have a single rate. You pay the same rate on sales taxes. You don't on income taxes. You have a graduated rate. When income falls, you're losing that top bracket disproportionately. Sales taxes, it's a proportional draw. Secondly, during a recession, most households will cut back on savings as well as consumption. So the consumption won't drop as much percentage-wise. Now, a lot of that depends on the kind of base you have. Some states have a very volatile base because they tax investment goods, they tax consumer durables, don't tax things that are more stable. So a lot of that varies by the state. But the other thing that's happened here in this recession has been that consumption's held up very well. Housing market's been strong, auto market's been strong. So those sales tax states have done much better in terms of volatility than has income tax states.
We need to be wrapping up here pretty quickly.
Okay, I think I'm just about done, Mr. Chair.
If you look at the income tax collections, of course, the number that you're very well aware of, if you compare state tax collections, Oregon is most dependent on the personal income tax. It's more dependent on a single source than any other state in the country. Washington is second with about 64% of its tax revenue, total state tax revenue, coming from the sales tax. Why don't you skip ahead to the last one? The last thing I wanted to point out, Mr. Chair, in terms of the forecast you look at, I know it's you're looking at the growth rate of 18% or 13.5% if you adjust for the pension and kicker refunds that have been sent out this current biennium. But just looking at the raw dollars of general fund resources, one of the problems that you have in the budgeting process is your spending hasn't caught up with your revenue decreases. And you compare that with the late 90s where expenditures were always running behind revenue. And that's just a product of having forecasts come in over. If revenue's coming in over forecast, you accumulate a big beginning balance. The biggest one was 97-99, following that huge jump in 95-97. You came into the biennium with an $800 million beginning balance. That was available to you to budget. It was in the bank. Now you can see, even the last two biennia, you still had over $300 million in beginning balance. So you add that to your revenue to get your resources for your appropriations. Now, 03-05, we're coming in optimistically looking at $21 million, assuming that the $110 million deficit has been taken care of through administrative adjustments by the governor. You've got only a $21 million beginning balance. So even with the rapid revenue growth that's projected, and even if that materializes, then you're still at about $10.9 billion for resources, which is about 4% higher than you were in 99-01. So about 4% over a four-year period, and you know what's going on in terms of costs and caseloads and so forth that's affecting your budgeting decision. So that's the resource situation you're in. And the small beginning balance is a big factor. Is that essentially, if you have a recession, it usually takes two biennia to work through the spending system.
Thank you very much, Paul. Appreciate it. Very good. Well, we know we're up against. Tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock, is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Tomorrow, 9 o'clock, we'll have a general overview of the education program area, and then we'll get into individual agencies within that program area, the same type of review of what's in the governor's budget.
Mm-hmm. Could I add something, Mr. Chair? You'd mentioned the analysis of the forecast process. Our House Revenue Chair has directed us to do a review of the forecast process, and we will have some recommendations along some of the things that were mentioned and some other things, and that report will be given to the House Revenue Committee next Thursday. We'll make sure that this committee receives that report, too.
Great. Thank you very much. With that, we're adjourned.